Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, you know that music well. Hail to the Chief, played whenever the Commander-in-Chief, the most powerful person in our country and potentially the world, enters a room, begins a ceremony. The question is the President the most powerful person in the country and the planet? Well, probably. But there is somebody very close to that person who actually controls so much of what the president gets access to, who the president gets, gains access to the president. And this is a fascinating conversation, I think, we're about to have, and a fascinating book you need to read if you haven't. My guest joining me now, Chris Whipple. He's the author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency, The Importance of the Chief of Staff. Chris, welcome to the podcast. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for the kind words. Good to be here.
Yeah, well, of course, now you've joined me on my Politics Tonight show a couple of different times, and for good reason. First, when the book came out, we wanted to talk about it. But secondly, because lately, as we have a new chief of staff, already a turnover in the White House with General Kelly in that role, I just wanted my listeners to be able to get an opportunity to have a good sense of just how important this role is. We sometimes don't give it enough credit. So let me start by asking you, how and why is the chief of staff so very important to a president?
Well, you know, don't take my word for it. James A. Baker III, the quintessential chief under Reagan, says it's the second most powerful job in government. Dick Cheney, who was Jerry Ford's 34-year-old White House chief, and it's a great story that I tell in the book about Cheney, says that the chief of staff has more power, if you want to put it in those terms, than the vice president. What Cheney doesn't often go on to say is that that's true, except for when Cheney was vice president. You know, the truth is the White House chief it's hard to imagine doing the job without an empowered White House chief. He's famously the gatekeeper who controls access to the Oval Office, giving the president time and space to think. He's the so-called honest broker of information, making sure every decision is teed up with accurate information on both sides. He's the person who executes the president's agenda. He is, at the end of the day, the person who has to tell the president what he does not want to hear. That has not happened to date with this president.
You know, it's funny, you just said something. I hadn't asked you this before, but it struck me when you referred to he whatever, and it just hit me as I think about all the chief of staffs you write about, and you talk to everybody who's still alive and give us the historical perspective as well. Am I right? There has never been a chief of staff who isn't a white guy.
That's absolutely true. I mean, there have been no women. I mean, think about it. How many female presidents have we had? How many female campaign managers have we had? You know, maybe one. So it'll happen someday. It almost happened under Obama. There was one contender named Nancy Ann DeParl, who was the brains behind Obamacare, but she didn't really have the political chops, the connections on Capitol Hill. So it's been an all male club so far.
Yeah. Just a word of history on this. I mean, because there is no mention, you write about this in the book, there's no mention of chief of staff in the Constitution. The founders didn't see this role. They didn't see this sort of appointed, unconfirmed, powerful role. They didn't envision this.
No, it really began, I mean, you could argue it began with Harry Truman. Eisenhower had a chief of staff named Sherman Adams, who was famous. But I really trace the modern empowered White House chief to Nixon's H.R. Haldeman. Of course, the irony of that is that Haldeman was ultimately undone by Watergate, the biggest scandal in political history. But he's the guy who wrote the template for the empowered chief, the one I just described, which presidents have strayed from at their peril. Every president who has tried to govern without an empowered White House chief in the Haldeman model has paid the price and learned that lesson.
And in fact, in the book you write about, I mean, a couple come to my mind because I've read your book carefully, enjoyed it so much. But Jimmy Carter, who is, of course, post that era you're talking about, but LBJ also prior to Nixon. Both of them, they were like their own chiefs of staff.
JFK before LBJ as well made the mistake of thinking that he didn't need to anoint anybody as first among equals. He had a lot of people coming and going from the Oval. After the Bay of Pigs, he relied heavily on his brother Bobby to be a sounding board and a confidant. LBJ, the same way. If anybody, you would think if anybody could run his own White House, it was LBJ. And for a while he did, but in the end, of course, it ended badly with Vietnam. So, you know, Jimmy Carter, again, possibly the most intelligent president of the 20th century, trained as a nuclear engineer. But he wasn't smart enough to run the White House by himself. And 2.5 years in, he finally gave the job to Ham Jordan, who incidentally turned out to be the wrong guy for the job.
So important to pick the right guy. And you write, I think my mind goes to 9-11. We're going to talk about Trump, of course, but I want to work my way there. On 9-11, Andy Card was George W. Bush's chief of staff. And you write in the book about how essentially it was Andy Card who told the president, you're not going back to the White House. And it raised a question from, this was after 9-11 happened. And it raised a question, you just said, the second most important person. Well, that almost sounds like Andy Card was even more important than the president, making decisions for the president.
In fact, it was really a case where Andy Card stepped up and told the president what he didn't want to hear, and quite frankly, told the president, no, we're not going to do that. George W. Bush was furious on Air Force One. This was moments after they'd left the Florida school and were about to take off, and Bush was adamant. He said, I am the president of the United States. And Andy Card said, well, I'm sorry, sir, but I just can't recommend that. We're not going to D.C. He was backed up by the Secret Service, of course. That was a case where Andy really successfully spoke truth to power, to use the cliche.
As I read the book, I found it fascinating because sort of you go from paragraph to paragraph, and 1 minute you're talking about domestic issues, and then we're in a foreign crisis, and then we're talking social issues. And I thought, is this disjointed? Is this because Chris can't get these? And then I realized, no, that's the life of the chief of staff and the president.
Yeah, it's indescribably relentless, 24/7. You get all of the blame and none of the credit. Erskine Bowles, who was a reluctant interview. I mean, it took me a while to get him to sit down. He was Bill Clinton's third chief of staff, of course, and really effective. But he said, you know, in a typical morning, you go through Bosnia, Northern Ireland, the economy, the environment, and then you'd have lunch. It's an indescribably difficult job, and it's exponentially more difficult than anything John Kelly has done so far.
When you and I first met, you were doing a presentation at the Union League Club, part of their author series. We came down and chatted there for a while, and joining us in our conversation was Bill Daley, who, of course, you know, brother, obviously, of the former mayor, but he was also a chief of staff for a while for President Obama. And so we talked a lot about Bill's role and the fact that you wrote that he was kind of a bad fit from the start, which was kind of fun to hit him with. But we didn't really concentrate a lot on Rahm Emanuel. Now, Rahm Emanuel, of course, is sort of an iconic figure in Chicago because of who he is and who he plans to continue to be as he runs for re-election. Talk to me about Rahm. How effective of a chief of staff was he?
Well, there's a great story that I tell in the book about Obama, and this was 6 weeks or about that before he was even elected. He had a very private meeting in a Reno, Nevada hotel room, and he flew in some of Clinton's former chiefs of staff, and the subject on the table was who should his chief be. It was secret because he didn't want anybody to think he was measuring the drapes before the election. But typically, right out of the gate, the first thing Erskine Bowles told him, Erskine is great because he has no filter. He's just blunt. And he said, leave your Chicago friends at home.
Which he did not.
Obama didn't wind up following that advice. He chose Emanuel, and I think Emanuel was a good choice for the beginning of Obama's term. Look, a crazy choice if you think of no drama Obama and Rahm, and yet he needed somebody who knew the Hill absolutely inside out. He needed somebody who could get stuff done in a hurry, pass a stimulus bill, You know, the auto industry was about to go belly up. They had a lot of stuff on their plate. And, you know, Rahm is a guy who, as Leon Panetta puts it, he takes the hill.
A very sarcastic guy, very powerful guy, but of course he would have to listen to the President of the United States. But one thing was interesting, and I think Rahm himself would say he was wrong. The president had to decide what his kind of signature achievement was going to be in those first, in that honeymoon period. And the president wanted to go for health care. Rahm said, don't do it. And the president didn't listen to him.
Yeah, Rahm wanted to go with financial reform first, you know, before health care. Rahm had been burned by health care back in the Clinton White House when Hillary famously, infamously did her own plan behind closed doors, and it was a disaster. That was an impossible lift. So Rahm brought those scars to the experience with Obama, and he argued for a much less ambitious health care plan. And at the end of the day, Obama won the argument. There was fierce debate, and Obama won the argument, and Rahm saluted and went to work. And as he told me, you know, he came in that weekend to the office despite his son's bar mitzvah and worked the phones all weekend, and off they went. They got it passed.
And so as you talk about Rahm being the importance of that strong character and knowing the hill, let's move on up to the Donald Trump days. His chief of staff already gone, Reince Priebus. And the positive part of a Reince pick was Rahm knew the hill, head of the Republican Party. He knew the players. That is
Priebus,
a
yeah.
character you'd want in a chief of staff. Why was it such
Priebus,
a disaster?
You know, he knew the hill a little bit. I mean, he didn't know it very well. I mean, he did bring a good relationship with Paul Ryan to the table. He'd been effective at the RNC, but in my opinion, he really failed as chief of staff. You know, he was a sycophant. He was unable to. It was really dramatized by that surreal cabinet meeting that they had that was right out of the Manchurian Candidate, where everybody competed to be more obsequious than the next. And
that was a frightening thing to watch, I got to tell you.
Everybody just won that contest for being the chief sycophant that day. But, you know, he failed to tell Trump what he didn't want to hear. But in fairness to Priebus, it was mission impossible from day one with Trump, because Trump failed to empower his chief of staff as first among equals. You can't do the job unless the president gives you the authority to do it. And as Erskine Bowles told me, the moment you're no longer speaking for the president, people can smell it, they can sense it, they can feel it within seconds, and you become nothing but a glorified scheduler.
He was in and out fairly fast, but he wasn't the quickest chief of staff in history, right? I think Al Haig just made it about a month.
You know, the last general who was White House chief of staff, Al Haig, was Gerry Ford's first chief of staff and lasted just a little bit more than a month. He, of course, had been Nixon's chief before Nixon's resignation. But one of the reasons he didn't last is because Gerry Ford had a model of governance that was a lot like Donald Trump's. Everybody came and went. Nobody was empowered, no chain of command, and Ford called it the spokes of the wheel, with Ford at the center. Well, it was a disaster. And within a month, he was begging his old pal Don Rumsfeld to come in and whip the place into shape, which Rumsfeld did, but only after Ford gave him the authority to do it.
So, by the way, I remember there was almost a funny ending to that spoke in the wheel story, right? A chief of staff who got the broken spokes of a bicycle wheel.
Yeah, you know, it became an in-joke in the Ford White House, the idea of the spokes of the wheel. And Cheney came in on his last day as Ford's, by the way, very effective 34-year-old White House chief of staff, but they lost the election to Carter. And Cheney came in that last day, found this package, unwrapped it, and inside it was a present from the staff, and it was a mangled bicycle wheel with every spoke broken. Cheney loved it, but instead of taking it home and putting it on the garage shelf, he left it on his desk and wrote a note to his successor, Hamilton Jordan. And the note said, "Dear Hamilton, beware the spokes of the wheel." Dick Cheney.
That could be a line in the musical Hamilton, if you think about it. They ignored
Cheney's advice, as incoming presidents
right.
often do. I mean, to me, the amazing thing I learned about in doing this book is just how often presidents make the same mistake again and again and again. And one of the reasons is because they come in full of hubris, intoxicated by their electoral victory. Sound familiar? And they come in and their attitude, as Cheney put it to me, toward their predecessors is, well, if you guys are so smart, how come we beat you?
Right.
But, you know, governing is nothing like campaigning. And that's a lesson Trump has yet to learn. You cannot govern the way you campaign. It just doesn't work. And he has not figured this out yet.
So we get General Kelly, as you said, only the second general since Al Haig who lasted a little more than a month. For a while, it looked like Kelly was making a difference. The president's wasn't tweeting so much. And then it might have just been that he was sleeping. I don't know, because, boy, the tweet storms have started since. My question is, give me your prediction on does this general make it as chief of staff for a while, short-lived? He looks like he's got some control. He says that Ivanka, Jared, everyone's going through him. Of course, he can't control what happens after hours when everybody's having dinner up in the residence.
Well, look, it's with Kelly, it's good news, bad news. The good news is that he seems to have consolidated his authority. He seems to be empowered within the White House, you know, with the chain of command, closing the door to the Oval Office. All of that's good. But the problem is that making the trains run on time is just the beginning. Now comes the really hard part. You cannot, as Kelly apparently has been quoted as having told his friends, you cannot simply manage the staff and say, well, I'm not going to manage the president. That's part of the job. Now comes the tough part. He's got to deal with Donald Trump. He's got to inject discipline and focus into a White House that so far has had no discipline and no focus. It's not that the process is broken. There really hasn't been any process. And the, you know, one of the big jobs of the White House chief is to be, as I said before, the honest broker of information, especially at a time of crisis with North Korea or something else. You've got to be the person who injects fact-based reality into a White House that hasn't had any so far. And this is a president for whom discipline and focus are anathema.
Some say that this president actually kind of likes being surrounded by chaos. It's just one of the things he did in business, and he likes it here. But as a president in a White House with a chief of staff who is anything but that, here's a chief of staff who believes in the pecking order, right? He's military. Those two lifestyles don't go together.
Well, you know, Trump is finding out. He may not realize it yet, but as the rest of the world can see, you know, that doesn't work. You know, you can be a disruptor. But if all you want, and Trump is a great disruptor, but governing is a very different story. You know, as Ken Duberstein, Reagan's last chief of staff, very effective one, by the way, used to talk about Reagan. He said, you know, when you're campaigning, you try to annihilate your opponent. When you govern, you have to make love to your opponent. You have to build coalitions. You can't simply run around and fire up the base and, you know, tweet and threaten. That's not the way you govern. That's not the way you expand your base or get things passed on Capitol Hill.
Should a chief of staff be feared or respected or both?
I think, you know, you don't have to be the famous son of a bitch that, you know, Haldeman was described as the pluperfect son of a bitch for Nixon. That's not really the way to do it. The way to do it, I mean, the two best at it, in my opinion, were Jim Baker and Leon Panetta. Leon Panetta was described as an iron fist inside a velvet glove. You have to be able to motivate your staff. You have to be able to inspire them and lead them. You know, it's not intimidation. And I think it would be a real mistake if Kelly tried to be an imperial White House chief the way Don Regan was or John Sununu. Those didn't end well. You need to lead your troops and you need to be tough, but you can't just be the president's son of a bitch all of the time.
Cheney and Rumsfeld, you're right, they were buds. You know, they kind of had each other's backs. Here we have Jared Kushner fighting with Steve Bannon. I mean, a lot of power struggles between those. Is that also making life difficult for the chief of staff, if not for the president?
No question about it. I mean, when family is involved, when you've got competing power centers, You know, it complicates life and it makes things much more difficult. Again, Jim Baker did this in the Reagan White House. The Reagan White House was riven by ideological battles. You had family involved. You had competing power centers. But Baker prevailed because Baker was savvy enough to form alliances. I mean, Nancy Reagan became an ally. She was famously the personnel director. Mike Deaver, who was a deputy chief and like a son to Reagan, was also a Baker ally. He formed these alliances, and when the hard right came after him, he was able to prevail because he had his he was covered. He had his back covered. So it's an extraordinarily difficult job. It requires real diplomacy as well as toughness, and we're going to find out whether Kelly is up to the task.
And I just finally have to ask you, you've got Mike Pence, of course, some New York Times reports saying he's looking to be president. He denies it. My question for you is, how important is it that the vice president and the chief of staff get along?
Well, I think it's important. I mean, I think that you can't have a vice president who tries to act as chief of staff. I mean, that was a real problem in the George W. Bush White House, quite frankly. Cheney was empowered, and I think he made life very difficult for Andy Card. It made it hard for Card to be the honest broker of information when it came to the Iraq War, for example. So you've got to deal with the vice president. One last story. Back in December of 2008, when Rahm Emanuel was about to become White House chief, 13 living White House chiefs got together to give him advice. They went around the table. They finally got to Cheney. Cheney looked at Rahm and said gravely, "At all costs, control your vice president." Of course, it brought down the House, but there was a little bit of truth to it.
Right, yeah, and he would know. Chris Whipple, documentary filmmaker, writer, journalist, speaker. Your work has been on 60 Minutes, primetime, on and on. What are you working on now? What's next?
Well, I'd love to tell you about it, but I can't talk about it yet. But I will say that I'm looking at another really interesting project involving politics, and I'll let you know as soon as I've gotten a little further.
It's a bio on me, isn't it?
Well, that's a thought, an idea.
A fleeting thought. People can check Chris out at chriswhipple.net, W-H-I-P-P-L-E, chriswhipple.net, so you can eventually learn what this new project is. I hope he tells me before he tells the world. The book is The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. What a great read. I loved it. If you love the stories Chris told here, this book is full of those stories. If you like learning about the presidency, you love studying the presidency, this book is essential, because it tells you exactly how the presidency works and how it needs to work with the person who should be in control. Chris Whipple, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you.
Thanks again for the kind words. Appreciate it.
Sure, bye.
Art isn't easy.
We got to appeal to the kids.
Even when you're hot.
Why would you want to make an album like this anyway?
Advancing art is easy.
I think we ought to talk seriously about
financing
this.
Financing it is not.
Why take chances?
A vision's just a vision if it's only in your head.
Nobody respects your artistic integrity more than I do.
If no one gets to hear it, it's as good as dead.
You have to think about your career.
It has to come to life.
Yeah, that's what artistic directors do, bit by bit, put something together, and they've got to bring it to life. It might be a fiction story, it might be a book, it might be start out as a play, but whatever it is, how do you bring any piece of art to life? Well, to talk about that and the upcoming season at the Greenhouse Theater Center, I'm rejoined by one of the first guests on this podcast, if memory serves me correct, way back when. Jacob Harvey is the artistic director of the Greenhouse Theater Center. He's also a director of many of the shows that go on there because, you know, you're artistic director. You can kind of pick your own director. You might as well pick yourself. I would. And so he joins me again. Jacob, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be here.
Yeah, do you ever reject yourself as a director of a show that you want to direct?
You know, I have, actually.
Really?
I absolutely have. When we were picking the solo shows last year, there was a play that I initially thought I wanted to direct, and I was talking to another friend of mine who was a director, and she gave me such a strong vision for the show. I said, you know what? You're going to direct this play.
Wow. So I still have hope if I have an idea from here.
That's right. That's right.
So the Greenhouse Theater Center, by the way, it's at 2257 North Lincoln. It's the old Victory Gardens location, which moved over down the street to the Biograph. But just tell my listeners, remind us a little bit about the mission of the Greenhouse Theater under your artistic direction.
Sure. The core of our mission is growing Chicago theater. So whether we are hosting another theater company as a rental or a resident company, or we're producing our own work or creating new initiatives, we're always interested in growing local theater, growing local theater artists. And that is in terms of, you know, professional development and on an education side. And so as far as I'm concerned, no matter where you are in your career, if you are working in this building or you're working with us in some capacity, everyone's in the same playing field. The sandbox is big enough for everyone, so everyone should feel free to come and play in it.
And last season, you did such phenomenal things with a series, a solo performance series, a series of one-person plays. You had Gene Wygant, who I absolutely loved today. You had a show on Rose Kennedy. It was so wonderful. And this year, you're doing some other creative things. Let's start talking about it, and let's start with the show that's about to open, running through September 24th, unless it gets extended. I don't know the rules about whether you'll extend things, but we certainly want to see it at some point in August or September. And it's called Machinal. It's by Sophie Treadwell. Really interesting. It's like almost like film noir, right?
Yeah, and it's very episodic in the way it's written. The play is written in 9 episodes through this person's life. You know, Sophie Treadwell was a playwright, but also a journalist, and wrote this play during the height of the Expressionist period in the 1920s. And it is loosely based off an actual murder trial. Ruth Snyder. Yeah. Oh yeah, it really happened. It's about the first woman in New York to receive the electric chair. Actually,
wow. She's in an unhappy marriage, and then she's got this lover, and you know, it's a story that we could read about today. But it is sort of interesting that it's a story that actually occurred many, many, many decades, almost 100 years ago, almost.
That's right. That's right. And then you just touched on it right there. That you know, one of my primary reasons for programming this piece is when I revisited this play, I am reminded that there are so many similarities in the way that the world of this play is built to the world we currently live in today. You know, and I actually, funny story, I was interviewing designers for the play, and I gave it to someone to read, and her first question to me was, is this a new play?
Ah.
So it's really, you know, I think it's very relatable in that way. You know, I think the world that this character lives in is very similar to a world that we live in today in terms of, you know, the way society is built and sort of systems of oppression through society and the way we, you know, the way we mire through that.
You have something interesting in the shows. I was reading about it. You're directing it, which you do many shows, but you have a movement director. Elizabeth Margolius steps in. I can't am I just stupid? I looked and went, I don't remember seeing a movement director listed. I've seen choreographers. What's the movement director? Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm working with Elizabeth, as you mentioned, and also a wonderful gentleman by the name of Nick Thornton, and together the three of us sort of have made this directing triad of this team. And a movement director is sort of, you know, it's more of a common thing in the UK, I think. You know, if you're familiar with Stephen Hoggett, right,
yes.
Or, you know, and the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, that's what he does, is movement direction. And oftentimes he's referred to as a choreographer, but in my mind, that's really what it is, where you're using movement, you're using physical life to enhance the story and enhance character. So every movement, every cross, every beat, every gesture is very delicately curated in the interest of enhancing the story into the style.
And by the way, my favorite actor already is Paul Michael Thompson, because I'm Paul Michael Lisnick, so I want to understudy. I want to understudy for him, because all you would have to do is change the last name in the program, and like the first two names could stay the same.
Oh, piece of cake.
Yeah, like makes it, it's like a total money saver.
I love it. I think you'll really love this cast. They're really a phenomenal group and a phenomenal ensemble.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I do have to ask you one other thing. I want to talk about some other stuff, but some of the characters' names. I mean, you have like young woman, but then there's people who the character is track 7, track 4, track 5. Is that because it's a serial kind of a thing?
Yes, you know, the play, when you read the script, it has 30, 40, 50 characters in the whole play. And so we tracked it down for 10 actors. So you'll see one actress who plays the young woman whose character's name is actually Helen, who is the character that's based off of Ruth Snyder, who the case is surrounding. She plays the same person through the whole play. But everyone else around her evolves to create the different archetypes of the people in her life. I think that helps enhance the idea that this, although this story story takes place in the 20s, the story could happen today. And this is part of her life. It's part of all of our lives. And, you know, the ensemble is us. We are part of this systematic machine of society. And so we were able to do it with, you know, 10 actors, but there was a revival on Broadway that Roundabout Theater Company did a few years ago, and I believe they had a cast of about 25. So I think it's kind of open to interpretation of how you want to stage the play.
Well, it's called Machinal by Sophie Treadwell. It plays like it's today's story. Jacob Harvey directing it, and it's going to play through September 24th. I should ask, might there be an extension on that, just because we won't be able to say that if the time comes?
You know, one can only hope,
we'll
right?
We'll see. Okay.
I hope it's successful enough to do that.
So we'll tell everybody to get their tickets at greenhousetheater.org. Theater spelled T-E-R. You know, I prefer T-R-E myself. But it's spelled greenhousetheater.org. But I want to talk to you while I have you. I've got to talk to you about something very cool going on, which is the MC10 Playwrights Ensemble. This, for me, when I first read about it, this was very Victory Gardens, which made sense because this was the original home of Victory Gardens, though there's probably no connection between that happening. But tell my listeners about... You brought these 10 magnificent people mid-career together.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, first of all, there's a thing I think that happens when we reach sort of that mid-career point where people think that, you know, you've reached a certain point in your career and you no longer need support. And I think that that's not true. I think that, you know, we as artists are always striving to grow and enhance ourselves, enhance our lenses, and be better. We always want to continue to grow and explore, right? You know, and the MC10 was actually born out of a concept from, it came from a company that I think was started in about 2003 in New York called 13P. 13P standing for 13 Playwrights. Sarah Rule was a part of it. Young Jean Lee was a part of it. And the idea and the mission of the MC10, which makes it different than any other than typical playwrights ensembles, is that it really puts the playwright in the driver's seat of the creation of the work. So what we say is that, you know, the playwright's driving the car. We are just giving them the gas to drive it. So we're collaborating very, very closely with these playwrights on their plays, but letting them dictate to us what the development of it should be, who is the right director, who is the right cast, and really, really putting them in a power of agency over the way the story is told. I think that, you know, when a new play is developed, it is our responsibility to help the writer achieve their vision of the play. And I think that that's something that doesn't always happen in the cogs and machine of the, you know, institutional and commercial theater, because, you know, once you get producers and artistic directors and other people involved, everyone else has opinions. And so, you know, I feel like my job in this instance is to support the playwright's vision and help the playwright achieve that goal.
And I tied it to Victory Gardens because, I mean, in my mind, when I think of Steppenwolf, I think it's the actor's theater. I think of Goodman as the director's theater. And when I think of Victory Gardens, I think even more arguable than the other ones, it is clearly the writer's theater, because it's such an emphasis on new work. And so that's why I say the fact that you were sort of the old home for Victory Gardens, in many ways playing on the importance of the writer, of the playwright, and developing that, because it all starts there. You can't act something if you don't have something to act.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, one of the things that makes this so powerful for us, too, is, you know, MC10 is a little bit of a play on words, right, because they are a group of mid-career playwrights, but they actually named themselves MC after Monte Carlo, which was the name of the bowling alley that used to be the second floor of our building. And one of the reasons that we were so drawn to this project together is, certainly nodding to the Playwrights Ensemble of Victory Gardens, but really embracing the storied history that this facility as a theater, but also just as a landmark in Chicago, has meant to the city for so long.
Yeah.
You know, there's such a history here.
I'm glad you mentioned the Monte Carlo. I was going to bring that up, the upstairs bowling alley. But by the way, some of the folks there, Philip Dawkins, and who's done such great stuff, the Homosexuals About Face Theater last season, which was amazing. Thomas Bradshaw, Goodman Theater Work. I mean, again, these are not people you found on the street. These are accomplished people who have done some great stuff already. And the notion of assisting them along to create the next great piece is just fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that there's something really remarkably powerful, too, about, you know, you mentioned Tom Bradshaw and Philip and, you know, some of these
and there's
really
eight
wonderful
others.
Playwrights. And you know, let's take Tom for an example, you know, or any of these writers that are writing plays for The Goodman, which is such a huge canvas to create on. And I think there's something extraordinarily powerful about being able to create for a more intimate environment, right? Like, there's a huge difference between seeing a show at The Goodman and seeing a show at The Greenhouse. You know, when you come to a play at The Greenhouse, you're definitely going to have a more intimate experience because the spaces are more intimate. And that offers a different type of set of tools in terms of your storytelling. And I think that that's really kind of an exciting thing for these playwrights that have been working in the larger canvas to kind of come back to those roots a little bit.
And I imagine as their various productions get put on, we will know as we follow what's up that this is a production and a product of the MC10 Playwrights Ensemble, whatever play that is at the time we're going to see.
That's right. We'll start doing them in our next season. There'll be at least one per season, and it will be that. It will be the MC10 play, and we will bill it as though it was a co-production between the two entities, because we really are giving that ensemble the agency as not only playwrights but as producers.
I just want to give a quick nod. It's about out of time, but overlapping a bit with Machinal is Mercy Killers and Side Effects by Michael Milligan. We have a red state, blue collar kind of guy who's got some issues to face. Give me a quick synopsis of what that play is going to be about. It opens up early September, playing into October.
Yeah, so we're billing it as the American Mercy Tour. It's two short plays, Mercy Killers and Side Effects. And Michael has been touring all over the country exploring artistic activism in its transpiring in terms of his work with these plays about the healthcare crisis in America.
Solo production, right?
Solo productions, yep. But so in Mercy Killers, you see a blue-collar, you know, gentleman living in a pre-Obamacare world. And then in the second play, you see a doctor living in a current time, a general primary care physician. And I think the issues that Michael is tackling are really, really important, especially right now in the middle of what we are experiencing in the new debate on healthcare. I think that if, you know, this is an issue that you want to learn more about or you are passionate about, this is definitely a piece that you want to experience, because he is telling it from all sides in a very unabashed way, and it's hard not to be impassioned by it.
Can't wait to see that. The Playwrights Ensemble is going to be fantastic, and of course, Machinal is just right around the corner getting ready to open all of this at the Greenhouse Theater Center. Again, the website to get your tickets, the easiest place to start is greenhousetheater.org. Again, theater spelled with an E-R at the end, because I always clarify when it's R-E as well. Greenhousetheater.org. The phone number is 773-404-7336. Jacob, you're just doing such a great job over there. I hope you're loving this and loving Chicago as much as we love having you live here now.
Thanks, man. I really do. I am so lucky to be here and working here, and I really, really love it. Thank you so much.
I'm hoping you're going to add me into the solo series in the future. I can do like just kind of a Topol Shalom Aleichem kind of a Tevye thing.
You got it. It's on.
All right. Committed. You're on the podcast. Committed. Jacob Harvey, I'll see you soon at the theater. It's always fun to do that. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, see you soon. Thanks, Paul.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.